The tantric tradition uses mantras like that, sometimes as magic charms and sometimes as tools of meditation. I'd like to give you an example of this just so that you have a sense not just of how a mantra operates, but maybe of what some of the tantric rituals look like in their mundane form. Example that I often talk about with my classes at Boston University is an example of a rainmaking ritual that comes from a tantric text known as the Hay Vajra Tantra, the Hay Vajra Tantra. And I'm going to give you an extemporaneous summary of this ritual for a very practical reason. The first time I read this ritual from the text itself to a class in Seaver Hall at Harvard, I read very precisely in the way in which you are supposed to read tantric rituals. And when I came to the end of it, all the fire alarms went off in the building and we all had to vacate the classroom. I don't know if this was related to the way I pronounce the mantras or not, but ever since then I've been a little wary of the power of this particular text. So I'm going to kind of summarize it to you in the hopes that maybe we won't set all the fire alarms off either where I'm speaking or where you're listening. Now the ritual is described like this. The practitioner, the shaman, the yogi, whoever it is who's performing this ritual, sits down, draws a circle on the ground, and begins to mark out the sacred space of the circle using a lot of ritual colors, often associated with bones, with death. Black color made by grinding up the bones from the cremation ground, other kinds of things to designate the space in a certain ritual way. Into the middle of the circle goes a pot with a snake inside. Why? Because snakes, especially nagas or cobras, are associated with the control of the rain. So what you're trying to do in this ritual is to invoke the power of the nagas, the spirits who control the rain. And then the tantric specialist begins to say a mantra that sounds something like this. This is an imprecise version of it in the hopes that we can avoid being in some way overwhelmed by its power. It sounds like this. Om, Guru, Guru, Gudu, Gudu, Gotaya, Gotaya. O Lord of the snakes, make the snakes to tremble. Om, Foot, Swaha. And if this doesn't bring the rain, the text says, then recite the whole ritual backwards. And if that doesn't work, then may the snakes' heads split like grapefruit. Phew, good. We said it, and no fire alarms went off, at least as far as I'm aware. This is a very common kind of ritual in the tantric tradition, a ritual in which you use mantras to perform, in this case, quite a mundane task, which is to bring rain. Mantras are used also more integrally in the quest for enlightenment in ways that we'll talk about in a minute. Now, all of this is to elaborate a little bit on the names of the tantric tradition, on the name Tantra, on the name Vajrayana, on the name Mantrayana. What is the fundamental teaching of the tantras? What are they trying to convey to us? Buddhist tantra, I think, was based on what I would call a radical extension of the doctrine of emptiness, understood as an assertion of non-duality. So think of tantra to begin with as simply a radical extension of the idea of non-duality, the overcoming of duality that is related in some way to that doctrine of emptiness that we've been discussing in the Mahayana. Now, how does the tantra do this? In ways that for us, I suspect, are quite striking. First of all, the Buddha, that peaceful old guy that we've seen in so many lovely forms in earlier Buddhist art, was pictured now in the tantric tradition not as a serene, peaceful, and calm figure. I can remember just a few lectures ago describing the Buddha seated in meditation and trying to convey to you with my voice how quiet and how calm he was. Now the Buddha is pictured as a figure who is full of passion and wrath.